My job at the Persuasion Institute is to monitor persuasive presentations, look at the communicators and see what they're doing right, that connects them with the audience, what they're doing wrong, which repels the audience, and quantify it and give you this information. It's interesting to see for many speakers, this becomes just a natural part of their ability. They don't have to think about it anymore. So during this audio, I want to talk about the power tools, the things that I've seen with great persuasive presenters that will make a big difference in your ability to persuade with power while you're doing a presentation. Let's revisit verbal packaging. What is the leverage of language? What words should you use and what words should you never use? Understand right here and now, the words you use affect attitudes, beliefs, and emotions. Presenters that know how to verbally package your presentation come across as more credible, competent, and convincing. As Mark Twain said, the difference between the right word and the wrong word is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug. The wrong word at the wrong time will definitely trigger a subconscious response and repel your audience. That's why when you go to a fine restaurant, let's say you go to a fine steakhouse, and you're trying to decide what you want to eat, and you ask the waitress, what's the difference between the filet mignon and the ribeye? And she'll smile and respond, well, the big difference is the ribeye is a little more marbled. Now, we all know that's fat, but she said marbled. That's verbal packaging. That's why the airlines say, in the event of cabin depressurization. What does that mean? It means you're flying at 30,000 feet and there's some type of hole in the plane. That's why when we give a college final, it's not a college final, it's a celebration of knowledge. We don't have used cars, we have pre-owned vehicles. We don't buy used clothing, we call them vintage. When we go out to eat, we call it fine Scottish cuisine, we don't call it McDonald's. Or a good one is the Patagonian toothfish. Doesn't sound very appetizing, so they call it Chilean sea bass. Walmart has an inventory control system. Not a theft device, but an inventory control system. We don't give a pitch, we give presentations. We don't sell people, we get them involved. We don't ask for money, we ask for their initial investment. We don't tell them to sign the contract or tell them to okay the paperwork. I could go on and on. We don't use if, we use when. We don't use could, we use can. We don't use try, we use will. Every word makes a huge difference in your success. Another one from the airline is, instead of saying late, it's a new arrival time. Because it matters, and it matters in your presentation. It's really interesting, a study done with three groups of people. They showed them a video of two cars colliding. And they all watched the same video. In the first group, they said, how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other? The second group, they said, how fast were the cars going when they hit each other? And the third group was, how fast were the cars going when they contacted each other? Same video, only difference was that one word, smashed, hit, or contacted, and there was a 10-mile-an-hour difference between contacted and smashed. And of course you want to stay away from what we call the weasel words. The weasel sneaks into a chicken coop, finds an egg, sucks everything out of it, and leaves the empty, hollow egg there. That's what a weasel word is. It's empty, it's hollow. Like, it might, it may, it helps, possibly, almost, well, up to 30%, they are not very convincing. We also find with words that you want to be clear, not confusing. Simple words will always outpersuade complex words. If you want to use a very intense vocabulary, you will lose a lot of your audience. And they still don't think you're that smart because they didn't get what you're saying anyway. So, simple things. Instead of saying annually, say every year. Instead of consistent, say steady. Instead of primary, say first. Instead of essential, say necessary. Instead of sizable, say large. Instead of persists, continues. Instead of utilizes, use. Instead of accomplished, did. Again, we can go on and on here, but I want you to think about every word of your presentation. You're crafting, you're sculpting this presentation. The fun one to watch is the politicians. One side will use the words like courage, dream, duty, empowerment, freedom, family, liberty, peace, pride, prosperity, strength, truth, vision. And then the other side, and both sides are guilty, will say this about the other side. Betray, cheat, corruption, crisis, destroy, excuses, greed, hypocrisy, obsolete, radical, self-serving, shallow, steal, and taxes. And they both use these different words to describe themselves versus describing the other side. And this is human nature. I just want to reiterate, you need to look at every word you use. You want to describe something in such detail and paint that picture that they can feel it, taste it, and touch it. I had one lady. I was training her on the power of verbal packaging, and I said, with verbal packaging, when you're really good at it, you could get someone to vomit, to throw up. She says, no, you can't. I said, yes, you can. She says, I don't believe you. I go, is that a dare? And she says, yes, it is. And I'm not even going to go into it. I vividly described a drink that had some contaminants and a few other things in there, some things that got stuck in the straw. I'm not going to go into the detail. My goal is not to make you vomit. But it only took about a minute and a half, and she picked up the trash can and ran away, and yes, it did happen. Not that I want you to do that. I'm just trying to make a point here, is that you want to make it vivid and descriptive so they can really feel what's going on. Be generous in the details. You see this with lawyers. They don't say their client is quadriplegic from the accident. They paint this picture. They make it real. They say something like, can you imagine lying in your hospital bed, the silence at night, except for the machines, and during the day, the phone rings. You know it's your family. You know you want to talk to them, but you can't pick it up. The sun starts coming through the window and shines on your arm and your leg, and you can't feel it. A fly flies in and lands on your face, and you can't swat it away. Your 4-year-old son comes running in the room, and you can't pick him up. And I'm not trying to depress you. I'm just giving you an example of painting that picture. Your voice, your inflection, your speaking rate, your vocal fillers, your volume, all are part of your voice. Volume is critical. If you're hard to hear, your audience will strain for a little bit, and then they'll give up. If you're too loud, it's like you're yelling at them. It'll make them nervous, tense, and uneasy. Monitor your pitch. That's the highness or lowness of your voice. The lower your voice, the more credibility you have. The rate. Remember, the faster you speak, the more persuasive you become. Using pauses effectively. Because when you're speaking to somebody in your audience and they're all excited and you pause, you feel what happened there? You paused and it really grabbed your attention. And you can categorize a lot of these with what we call vocal variety. And that's a change in your rate and your pitch and your volume. Giving yourself variety. It's not always the same pitch. It's not always the same rate. You vary it. You need to take a look at your pronunciation. That's the accepted standard of sound and rhythm for words. Doesn't matter if you think you're doing it right. Record yourself. Listen to yourself. What about dialect? That could be your accent, your grammar, or vocabulary from different parts of the world or different parts of the country. Some come across as more credible than others. Every word you use matters. Look at your verbal packaging. Look at every word you use. It'll make a huge difference in your success. Another thing I noticed that I want to talk about, which has to do with presentations, is telephone skills. The ability to use a telephone and use it in the right way is not only a form of presentation, but is a power tool of great persuaders. Because chances are you'll be following up on the phone, that you'll be using the phone, and yes, that is a presentation. One of the things we notice, and the question I get many times at our workshops, is how do you get people to call you back? Well, let's talk about this. Many people, they get somebody on the phone, and you have to realize when you get somebody on the phone, it is an interruption. You have interrupted them. Unless it was a pre-scheduled appointment, you have interrupted something. They didn't expect to talk about what you're talking about right now. But let's say you did get them on the phone. You were good with your questions. You found out what they needed and what they wanted, and they were getting excited. It sounded like a good fit. And then they want a little more information to compare it with the competitors. And you say, okay, you send some literature or send them to a website, and you make an appointment for the next week. Now, here's where a lot of people drop the ball, is they call them up next week, right on schedule, and they say, did you get the information? Did you read the information? Did you go to the website? Whatever it is. And the person says, well, no, not really. I'm not interested. Thanks anyway. And it happens all the time. Now, as we monitor this, what we're finding is they didn't have a chance to read it, or you caught them at a bad time. But here's what you need to understand. You should never ask the question, did they read it, did they see it, unless you spent the time to rebuild that emotional state. This is what I mean. When you talked to them the first time, you took great notes. You wrote down what they were interested in, what got them excited. And when you called them a second time, here's the rule. You talk about those things. You get them excited again. You rebuild the emotion. And when the emotion is at the level where you left them, then and only then should you ask if they've read the information or went to the website. Otherwise, you'll get the knee-jerk reaction of no. A lot of people ask, Well, should I leave a message? The answer is, it depends. If it's your fourth or fifth attempt and they're not picking up, leave a message. I would attempt to get a live body as much as possible until you're ready to give up and then leave a message. And when you do leave a message, leave some type of message using the Zeigarnik effect that leaves something unfinished. Something you need to send them, a report you need to show them, a website you want to send them to, a CD you want to send them. And if there's any interest left there, they will give you a call back. But understand, if you've blown it somewhere at the beginning of the presentation, they're probably just being polite and didn't want to hurt your feelings, telling you that it wasn't what they wanted or whatever excuse they came up with. Another critical part of the telephone is getting to the right person. First of all, getting past the screener and talking to the right person. Let's talk about getting to the right person. The numbers show that 64% of the time, you are giving your presentation over the phone to the wrong person. They're just politely listening while they're doing something else. Work on getting to the right person. Qualify them in the first minute to make sure they're the person that can use your product, service, or idea. Communication over the phone poses unique challenges. Face-to-face presentations are usually scheduled and planned, while phone conversations, as you know, are viewed as interruptions. The first challenge is your audience can't see your face, your body language, or your presence. Everything about you is being judged entirely through the phone. The first impression over the phone is just as important as a face-to-face contact. It is amazing how many companies are going to automated systems when one of people's top complaints is they're not getting a live body. The second most common complaint is that they're getting the runaround and being transferred from person to person. So let's talk about some of those complaints. The automated system we talked about, being tossed around. They feel like you're in a race to finish your script without using any interruptions so they can't object. They sense that you're rambling on and on. They're insulted by improper introductions and informal greetings, getting too friendly too fast, tone of voice, feeling pressured, feeling that the caller is only pretending to listen to them. They sense that the caller is a little disinterested and unempathetic. Many times they feel like they're being treated as they're stupid. Monotone voice, pronunciation, vocal fillers, lack of clarity, slow pace, excessive detail are some of the things you need to think about during your telephone conversation. This is what your audience is saying about you. You have to grab their attention in the first 30 seconds. That first 30 seconds, that first 15 seconds, that time frame, you have to introduce yourself or your company, be positive and enthusiastic. So what do the great persuaders do over the phone? They are prepared. Before the call is made, they think about it. They know the exact purpose and end result of the call. They smile during the conversation. Yes, study after study shows that it really helps. They're polite. They focus on the prospect's needs and wants. They keep the phone about an inch from their mouth. They use appropriate humor. They do use the phrases that you've heard before, please and thank you and you're welcome. They return phone calls within 24 hours, unless it's the weekend. They end on a very positive note. Thanks for your time. Have a great day. They never ask, how are you doing today? Because that's a telemarketing red flag. They qualify early. They're sincere and empathetic and have great listening skills. They keep control of the conversation through questions. They leave clear messages on the voicemail and a great reason to call back. Remember I said clear messages. You've had those messages that were hard to understand or too fast. You could even write down the number. That is not what you want. So always listen more than you talk over the phone. Vary your rate of speech. You do not want them to strain to hear you. And vary your inflection. A few more things about your presentation over the phone is never argue. And that's a true principle in negotiation, persuasion, presentations over the phone. What's the saying? A man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. You might feel good about winning the argument, but you've lost the audience, the prospect, forever. You're bigger than that. You're better than that. You have control of your ego and esteem. Don't argue. Don't come across as cocky and condescending because it turns them off and you'll never hear from them again. Be careful about sending literature or sending people to a website. That is a knee-jerk reaction for many for them to buy time and maybe get rid of you. Find out exactly what information they're looking for, exactly how you can help them out. Work on your questioning skills so you can find out exactly what they need to look at. And with that in mind, what we're finding is, over the phone, many persuaders' reluctance to close, thinking it needs two or three or four phone calls, maybe a couple of face-to-face visits, and they extend the persuasion process 3-4 times too long. What we want you to do is understand when you fulfill their wants and needs, there's no reason to send literature. There's no reason to call back. Go to your call to action and seal the deal. I know you're thinking, well, my product and service, what about this? What about that? There are times when they're ready, you can seal the deal sooner rather than later. Another power tool, categorized under understanding human nature, is understanding the term change. When you're giving a persuasive presentation, you are changing somebody's mind, somebody's spending habits, somebody's beliefs, somebody's values. You're changing something. You have to understand why people resist that change, why we're creatures of habit, why we follow the path of least resistance, why we want to wait till all our ducks in a row or everything's perfect before we decide on your product, your service, your idea. What are the four things that you need to hit during your presentation that's going to cause someone to change? Now, we all resist change, but everyone likes to change their income or change their health or change their weight. So we have to look at both sides here. Now, let's talk about some terminology here. There's a big difference between change and alteration. Alteration is an external thing. When people change their behavior when no one's watching. When someone's watching, they're eating the carrots and the celery, but when no one else is watching, they're eating a whole box of donuts. That's an alteration, and that's not going to help you. I want to talk about true, lasting, internal change. Change that comes from the inside. Remember, as a great persuasive presenter, you're helping them persuade themselves. The first thing that you need to take a look at is the mental programming, the psyche. Can they see themselves doing what you're asking them to do? Their minds need to be reprogrammed so they can see themselves doing what you're asking them to do, because society has probably told them they couldn't do it. Or they've told themselves why they couldn't do it. And they have all these excuses. No reasons, but excuses why they can't do it. And when they can finally see themselves doing it, then everything else falls into place. Let me give you an example to make this ring true. Many people, when they try to diet, they starve themselves. And then they start thinking about their favorite foods. Steak or French fries or ice cream. And they replay it over and over again in their minds. They think about that ice cream and how good it would taste, and it's just a matter of time before they have to have ice cream. Or French fries. Here's a good one, French fries. We all know French fries aren't that good for you. But people think about French fries. They're hot and they're salty and you get a dip in the ketchup and, oh, they taste so good. If that person wants to give up French fries, their mind has to be reprogrammed. So when they think about French fries, they don't start drooling at the mouth when they think about French fries. Just do something like this. Imagine going to a fast food restaurant, ordering a large order of fries, and you pour them out on your tray, you let them cool a little bit, and then you grab a whole handful as big as you can, and you hold your hand up in the air and you start squeezing as hard as you can. And you squeeze, and you squeeze, and you squeeze, and you have this yellowy, pulpy mass between your fingers that ooze out between your fingers, and the grease just starts running down your arm. And it pools and starts running more and more and starts dripping on the floor, this yellow, pasty grease that's clogging your arteries and giving you that pending heart attack. And you open up your hand and that gooey mass just about nauseates you, and you throw the mass against the wall and it sticks there. And you're wondering what it's doing to your body. And you've got all this grease on your hand, it stained your shirt, it's all over the floor. Now, I'm going to stop there. Do you get the picture? That's what needs to happen in the mind of the person you're trying to change, whether it's yourself or your audience. The second thing you have to get past is fear. Now, fear we know is an overblown doubt. And we have to understand that winning is all about losing. We know through life or sports or business, many times we lose more than we win. But losing's okay as long as we learn from it. But most people have a great fear of losing. They have a fear of failure. Some have a fear of success. You have to get them past the fear to help them change. And part of understanding fear and the fear of failure is understanding failure. Failure hurts, and a lot of people would rather do nothing than face failure again. And most people failed because of their inability to delay gratification. My early mentor Jim Rohn used to say, do you want to spend a day at the beach or own a piece of the beach? Let me add to that. Do you want to spend a day golfing or on the golf course? Do you want to spend a day shopping or on the shopping mall? Delayed gratification. Can they see themselves delaying gratification to do what you're asking them to do? Many people fail because of the lack of self-discipline. They might not try your product or service because they don't think they're disciplined enough to do it. Sure, everyone knows they should have a gym membership or a gym in their home, but maybe they know they don't have that much self-discipline and don't see themselves doing it, and that's why they don't do it. Or they're feeling overwhelmed. The piece of the pie is too big. As a presenter, you need to break it down to smaller, manageable, bite-sized pieces that they can see themselves doing. Following the weight loss example, losing 100 pounds is too big. Losing a half pound a day might seem more realistic. The next aspect of change is knowledge. Lack of knowledge. They don't have the tools. They don't have the knowledge to do what you're asking them to do. And you need to give that knowledge and make it look like it's simple and easy to do. Then you're one step closer to helping them make a change. Last but not least is lack of motivation. They can't motivate themselves to do it. They don't have the inspiration or the desperation, and that's your job as a presenter, as we talked about previously, is to find out where they fit in those motivational quadrants and push those buttons so you are able to motivate them to make the change. So just to review on this power tool, the four key things that anybody needs to have, yourself or your audience, to make the change. The mental programming, they got to be able to see themselves doing it. They got to get past any fear or any past failures in their life. You have to give them the knowledge and understanding on how to do it, and they have to be motivated to do it. Let me spend a few more minutes on that mental programming. If they can't see themselves doing it, it's not going to happen. The universe will not reward you physically until you believe it mentally. They have to have some type of foundation. Henry David Thoreau said, "If you've built castles in the air, your work need not be lost. That's where they should be. Now put foundations under them." Meaning that it's okay to dream, but you need to have some type of a foundation. So I'm going to teach you about the foundation of success. So it'll help you, but then you can also use it for your audience. The three parts of everybody's foundation is belief, thoughts, and vision. So let's talk about beliefs. Everyone has a belief system, and a belief is kind of is almost like a guidance system. And we've picked up our beliefs from society, from osmosis, from experience, visualization, our past, our parents, our family. We pick up these little beliefs along the way. Now, some beliefs don't matter. In fact, we have some strange beliefs. Walking under a ladder, Friday the 13th, breaking a mirror, stepping on a crack, your face will freeze that way, don't sit too close to the TV, and we can go on and on. And those beliefs probably don't matter. But I want to point out right now, you have conflicting beliefs in your mind. And when you have conflicting beliefs, you'll never hit the target because your beliefs are like a guidance system. If you shot a torpedo and it had two guidance systems, two things telling it what to do, it would never hit the target. An airplane coming in for a landing has two control towers telling it what to do, it would never be able to land. And right now in your mind, you have conflicting beliefs. Maybe you want to be an entrepreneur, but society's taught you need to work for a large corporation. Money's the root of all evil, but you want to be wealthy. Now, that's not a conflicting belief, but for many people, it is. You want to get out of debt, but you need to spend more money to get out of debt. So you need to get into more debt to learn the things you need to do to be successful in business to get out of debt. And I can go on and on. What I'm saying right now is in your mind, you have conflicting beliefs that have impeded your success. If you're wondering what's taken so long to be successful, I guarantee you, you have conflicting beliefs. And so as you look at your audience, they have conflicting beliefs. And you need to be able to address those and help them find their true belief. So that's the first part of the foundation. The second one, let's talk about vision. Vision. Remember, you can see it, taste it, touch it, feel it. Vision. Pure vision brings direction, persistence, and purpose. And that's what I want to point out. I don't care about your past. And I don't care about your past mistakes. Your future's spotless. All your family and friends are judging you on your past mistakes and past failures, not on your future potential. And that's true with your audience. All these people are going to judge them. They're worried about what's going to happen. And let me point this out, is that when your audience or yourself is stuck on worry, well, what if it doesn't work and what if this happens? It's because their vision of the future is not strong enough. So if you, in your life, get stuck on worry, it's because you can't see yourself doing the things that you want to do. And if your audience is worried about your product, your service, what if it doesn't work? They have no vision of the future. They can't see themselves using it. The third, thoughts. As Ralph Waldo Emerson says, a man is what he thinks about all day long. And you're a sum total of your thoughts. And it takes a lot of energy to control and redirect your thoughts. Notice I said redirect. See, there are many camps out there that say, oh, positive mental attitude, control your thoughts, that's stinking thinking. And there's some value to that, but no matter who you are, you're going to have a very negative thought enter your mind. Successful people have negative thoughts enter their minds. See, when a mediocre person has a negative thought, they listen to it, they dwell upon it, they give it energy, they give it some reality. A successful person redirects their thoughts into something more positive. They don't give it room to grow. You have to ask yourself, where are your thoughts taking you? And I'm telling you right now, most of your thoughts are negative. And what you think about the most, you attract. If you think about all the debt or not being successful or nobody liking you, that's what you attract. What is your dominant thought? What consumes you? What do you think about most of the time? It was Napoleon Hill of Think and Grow Rich that said, "Every man is what he is because of the dominating thoughts which he permits to occupy his mind. Thoughts which a man deliberately places in his own mind and encourages with sympathy, and with which he mixes any one or more of the emotions, constitute the motivating forces which direct and control his every movement, act, and deed." So, how is your past influencing your future? How is your audience's past influencing their future? Are they worried what others are going to think of them? Are you worried what others think of you? And of course, do their beliefs match their goals? And as we talk about this programming, the mental aspect of the game, and we talk about thoughts, I want to point out the word T, just like the drink, T-E-A, that your thoughts control your emotions, and your emotions control your actions. We have a conscious mind and a subconscious mind. And when you tell your conscious mind that you're a millionaire or you're a great presenter, and this is an important thing to do, again, because unless you believe it mentally, it's not going to happen physically. But the challenge is, let's take wealth for example. Someone sits down and says, I'm a millionaire. And their conscious mind comes at them and says, "No, you're not. You've been a failure your whole life." And they feel awkward and they stop trying. As we monitor successful people, very wealthy individuals, they repeat these phrases over and over and over again until they believe it. And when they believe it, their subconscious mind finds a way to make it happen. Because, as Napoleon Hill said, every impulse of thought that reaches the conscious mind is classified and recorded from which thoughts may be recalled. It's the recollection as the challenge. That's where your subconscious mind comes in. Because when your subconscious mind accepts an idea, it will not fight with you. It begins to act on it with knowledge, ideas, and wisdom, and you'll find a solution. And how does it talk to you? Intuition, instinct, impulse, it gives you ideas. The power of the subconscious mind is an incredible thing. And you need to program yourself as a persuasive presenter. You need to be able to see it in your mind. See yourself on the stage. See yourself one-on-one, whatever it is. And when that happens, and when you see yourself being successful, everything else will fall into place from the materials that you've learned on these audios to become an incredible presenter and persuader. The next power tool is your call to action. And I'm going to beat you over the head with this one because this is critical. This is why you're there. This is the most important part of your presentation. Don't change your demeanor. Be enthusiastic. Any rejection you receive is not personal. And a Harvard study shows it's the psychological qualities that make great persuaders. And remember, during this call to action, why people buy. They buy for their reasons. They don't want to be sold. And they're evaluating you. They're judging you. What is the criteria they use to judge you? Well, if you really want to break it down, let me give you the seven areas so you can think about this. First of all, they're evaluating or judging you. How's your knowledge level? What's your experience like? Do they trust you? They also evaluate on price, the value, the cost. What's the return on investment? They're evaluating the company. Is it one person? What's the reputation? Is it a large company? What's the history? Are they stable? Could they go under? Who else has done business with them? Next one, your product or your service. Is there quality? What are the features? What are the benefits? How's this going to help me? Then the guarantee. Wow, the risk versus the reward. I'm liking this. I'm not quite sure. I'm sitting on the fence. It has a great guarantee. The next one, the subconscious trigger we call intuition. It feels right. They've done a gut check. It feels good. Let's do it. And the next one we've been talking about is forecast. Or they can visualize. They can see themselves doing it. So let me repeat those. They're judging and evaluating you, the price, the company, your product or service, your guarantee, their intuition, and their forecast of the future. Can they see themselves doing it? The big question I get in training is, when is it time to ask for the money? When is it time to ask for their business? Because I've already talked about that you're talking too much. You're spending too much time doing this. You're spending too much time doing this. When is it time? How do you know? Well, let me give you a few indicators. If you're looking at them face to face, their facial expressions relax because mentally they've made a decision. They start looking at the paperwork a little bit more. If there's a spouse or a partner there, there's approving glances. Or a spark in their eye, they start to lean closer to you. They begin to mirror and match you a little bit more. Their head starts to nod up and down just a little bit. Or if you're over the phone or face to face, you hear things like, "Oh, that's a good deal. Oh, that's not expensive. You know, I could see how that would work. You know, I could put that right there in my living room. You know what? That would really help me out." So when you're close, you hear things about specific terms, your warranty or your guarantee. They might want to schedule a demonstration, talk about delivery, references. Look for these. You can read people. You can know exactly when it's time to shut up and ask for their business. You are the expert. You are the one with authority. Act like it. Use questions. Come across as competent. Come across as convincing, and the doors of persuasion will swing open to you. Another power tool I want to revisit is objections. I've mentioned earlier that great persuaders solve objections before they happen. That is your goal during your presentation, is to solve every objection before it happens. If you can't, and a few might come up, and that's okay, learn to love those objections. Don't get defensive. Don't get sarcastic. Don't get nervous. Don't get tense. Questions and objections can indicate a great interest in your product or service. They're showing you that there's a hidden request for some type of information, and it tells you how to modify your presentation. Now, there's some objections that are full of venom that you don't want to answer, but I want to revisit. The best time is before. The next is during. But sometimes you might want to put them off till later. Get them a little more excited about your product or service. Most objections is they can't see themselves using their product or service. Take network marketing, for example. They're excited about the business. They can see how it's going to make them money. But they can't see themselves talking to their family and friends. All they can see is their family and friends mocking them and making fun of them. But then they say, "Well, I can't, it's too expensive, I can't afford it, I don't have the time." So the first thing you need to do is find out if this is a knee-jerk reaction or it's a true objection. If I tell someone you can make $50,000 a month on real estate, they'll say, "Well, yeah, but you have to deal with renters." Does that make any sense? Who cares? If you're making $50,000 a month, most people don't care about dealing with renters. Or you say, "Hey, I just flipped this real estate property, made $250,000. And they say, "Well, yeah, but that took you 3 months of hard work." Okay, doesn't make any sense. It was worth every minute during those 3 months to flip that property. Or you tell someone, "Yeah, I make an extra $5,000 a week off the stock market on the internet." And they say, "Well, yeah, but you have to stay in front of your computer." If the knee-jerk reaction doesn't make any sense, or it's something that you've already addressed before, it's one of those "I can't see myself doing it" objection. And you need to back up and realize they can't see themselves doing what you're asking them to do. Solve that and then go back into your call to action. So relevance is a big issue in being able to tell if it's a knee-jerk objection or a true objection. Eye contact is an interesting one here too. When they do this knee-jerk reaction, most people will look away from you for a few seconds, and then they'll go back and maintain eye contact. Maybe they're not interested in a solution. You've already mentioned the solution, or you're coming out with a solution, but no matter what you say, it doesn't matter. Or, especially if what they say surprises you, it's usually a knee-jerk objection. So that aside, let's say you have to solve an objection. Someone's asked a question in your audience, one-on-one, or a group of people. How do you solve a true objection? Great presenters and great persuaders know exactly how to do this. They enjoy it. They like it. It's part of an exciting presentation. The first thing you ask when someone comes up with an objection is, can you solve it? If you are selling a large order of office furniture to a company and they've just declared bankruptcy, you can't really solve that. And then when the objection comes, a couple things. When you hear an objection coming, let them finish. Now, you've heard it many times before. You're excited you know the answer. You want to cut them off. You jump in because you know the answer. Whoa, whoa, time out, back up. This is the first time they've ever voiced that objection. Let them finish. You're showing sincerity. You're listening. You're thinking about it. Take some time to think about it. Restate it. So what you say is, and then repeat it and rephrase it. Because a lot of people just aren't quite sure what their objection is until they vocalize it. And sometimes they vocalize it wrong the first time. So you want to restate it. You don't want to solve the wrong objection. It's a waste of time and it sucks the energy out of the presentation. And always compliment them. "Thank you for asking that. Thanks for bringing that up." You want to keep the door open and let them know you appreciate their questions, their concerns, and their objections. Because if you don't, they're not going to bring them up again. Or other people in the audience won't bring them up. When they know that you're open to suggestions and concerns and objections, other people will be more willing to bring up their objections and concerns. And make sure you're not condescending. And most presenters don't think they are, but that's how they come across. And the person feels like they asked a dumb question and they brought up an invalid objection. Never be condescending. Be open to listening. Be open to objections. And give them room to save face. Don't back them into a corner. Let them know there are always different options. Learn to love objections. Learn to solve them ahead of time. Another power tool of professional, persuasive presenters. Another power tool is understanding mood. Mood matters. First of all, let's talk about your mood. You just fought with somebody on the phone. You're upset. You're angry. You got stuck in traffic. Whether you talk to somebody on the phone or face-to-face or start to give a presentation, you put on that fake smile and you think you're getting away with something, but your audience can sense it. They can sense something's wrong. It makes them a little nervous and uneasy. They're not saying to themselves, oh, they just fought with their spouse. It's just a subconscious trigger. So first of all, great presenters, great persuaders have the ability to go from a bad mood to a positive mood very quickly. And second of all, you have to understand the mood of your audience. If they're starting off in a very foul mood, a very negative mood, you have to understand it's not time to persuade. Because when people are in negative moods or low moods, they retrieve negative thoughts and memories. They start comparing and analyzing what could go wrong, and they're much harder to persuade. On the flip side, good moods, people retrieve happy thoughts and experiences. They're more aware of your positive qualities and the positive qualities of your product or service, and they're much easier to persuade. Even in restaurant studies where people come in to evaluate the food, if they don't like the person across from them, if that person puts them in a bad mood, it affects the food evaluations. The mood of job interviewers, the studies show their mood depends on how they evaluate the other person. Countless studies show that mood matters. You have to have the ability through stories or humor or your presence or your message to get your audience in a good mood before you start persuading. People have enough challenges in their life. They think everything's going wrong. Life's beating them up. Your goal is not only to get them in a good mood, but to trigger some happiness. And true happiness comes from within. How can you trigger happiness in your audience? And as Viktor Frankl said, a survivor of the Holocaust and a psychologist said, happiness is a condition rather than a destination. Happiness cannot be pursued. The more we aim at happiness, the more we miss our aim. It is a side effect of having a purpose and meaning to life. So if you can tap into your audience's purpose, what they really want, their values, their goals, their dreams, their aspirations, you're going to trigger some happiness if they can see themselves doing it. Because why aren't people happy? Why isn't your audience happy? Well, they don't feel like they have any sense of control of their future, of their income, of their health, of something. They don't feel like they're in control. The second one is they've given up on their goals. They have no meaningful goals. The reality is they're either working for somebody else's goals or their own goals. And most people have given up on their own goals and they work for somebody else's goals. And they don't set their goals, like we talked about earlier, because they might fail. And a big one is they have conflicting goals. A couple of goals that conflict. They want to spend more time with the family, but they want to be financially independent. Would be a standard conflicting goal. So, as a great presenter, as a great persuader, you trigger happiness. You have the ability to change mood. You have the ability to get them from worry to vision. You get them past anger and help them calm down to see how you can help them out. You're able to show empathy, that attention, that praise, that encouragement, that understanding. You can read people's emotions, that emotional intelligence. Daniel Goleman, who wrote the book Emotional IQ, says, understanding emotions is more pertinent to leading a successful life than having a high intelligence. Understand emotions, understand your audience, understand exactly what you need to say and do to change mood and to trigger happiness. You have the ability to become an incredible, persuasive presenter. This information and these audios will change your ability to present with power, to educate, inspire, and entertain with passion, compassion, and purpose, to have an incredible presence, to come across as charismatic, to have people run to you and want your product or service or even support your idea. It can be learned. It can be mastered. It can be fine-tuned. You follow these principles. You listen to this audio again and again until it becomes second nature. You will become a persuasive presenter, and it will not only change your income, it'll change your life, and you'll have the ability to make the world a better place.